Hello, science enthusiasts! Welcome to the Science Podcast! We have spooky science up to date and pet tips and some interesting chats with science folks.
Happy Halloween! Hello, everybody. We are just hoping you're happy and healthy out there. The numbers of coronavirus are kind of scary. They're kind of going up. I think if we check any other metric in the world, there's very few countries where the numbers are leveling or going down. I know the numbers are going up in Europe, and I know the numbers are going up in the United States. And in Canada, they're going up too, to concerning levels. What does that mean? Well, our chief medical officer of Alberta, Dr. Dina Hinshaw, she said something that was really powerful, and I've used it before. I've parroted it back to kids, to my students I teach, and on social media, is that until we have a vaccine, the only thing we have is each other. We only have each other to stop the spread. And I know as in Canada, it's getting cold. People are inside more than they are outside, which is a problem for spread. And everybody's just getting tired of physical distancing. I know there's still not a lot of mask adoption in different places, but the vaccine is not going to be here in 3 weeks. And even within the month, if it's announced that there's a safe and effective vaccine, by the time you or I get it, it could be months. It could be the spring. So that's a long time. And again, the only thing we have is each other. So if you're listening to the podcast, just do the best you can to wear a mask, continue to wash or disinfect your hands. I guess that's the good thing about the podcast and social media is there's still some social interaction there. We love interacting with people on social media through Bunsen and Beaker's account. And the podcast allows at least you to hear my voice and hear the voice of other science guests. On the podcast today, in science news, we're going to pick up with the OSIRIS-REx story. I talked to Gideon Kidd of I've Pet That Dog last week, and one of the facts was about OSIRIS-REx. So we'll do a deep dive on OSIRIS-REx. It's super interesting. In pet science, because Halloween is coming up, we've got a Halloween-specific article about dogs and dye, or pets and dye, because you might want to be sprucing up what your dog looks like for Halloween, and there's some danger involved. Our guest this week is Daniel Bush, who's a chemist and a baker. So she uses the science of chemistry to make some sweet, sweet baking. And I had such a fun chat with her. We went so long over, so it's been a bit to edit it down to podcast size. I don't know. I just really connected with everything she was saying. She's such an interesting person, and I can't wait for you guys to hear the interview. Hey, dogs, do you know what the most important rule in a chemistry lab is? Never lick the spoon. Okay, on with the show, because there's no time like science time. This week in science news, we're going to talk about NASA's OSIRIS-REx spacecraft. You may have saw the GIF, or is it GIF? I don't know, the little video that I posted to Bunsen and Beaker's account of the space boop. A little arm came out and booped the asteroid, or nudged it, or poked it, whatever kind of verb you'd like. But why did it do that, and why is this such a big deal? Well, great questions. As I said in the intro, I talked to Gideon Kidd last week for Woo or Wow, and we had a lot of fun. And one of the clues that I gave him that was incorrect was the spacecraft booping one of Mars's moons, but in fact it didn't. It booped an asteroid named Bennu. I remember when they launched OSIRIS-REx, like in the back of my head, this is a while ago, they launched this thing. And it's been circling Bennu for 2 years, since December in 2018. Now, why did it take it so long to actually touch the asteroid? Well, the asteroid is really small, and they didn't know what it would look like, so they couldn't just send it there to land. The spacecraft had to scan the entire surface of this asteroid to find a good location to get closer to take the sample. And they originally thought that Bennu, this asteroid, was going to be really smooth and super easy to traverse for their spacecraft. And boy, were they wrong. This asteroid was insane, crazy difficult. And they did. It took them a while to map the surface of the asteroid, and there's lots of good data and pictures it was sending back. And they found a place for it to, I guess, make its approach. And even then, the people who were controlling OSIRIS were super, super scared because it had to go by this giant outcropping, which the team named Mount Doom. So they actually named like this outcropping of rock Mount Doom. So I don't know what the Eye of Sauron would be in this situation. And I guess if they get into trouble, there's no Gandalf or eagles to come save you out in the middle of outer space. With bated breath, the spacecraft made its approach. And because of it's so far away, there's a huge time difference between Bennu, where the, you know, where Bennu is in outer space, and NASA headquarters. So they had to send the instructions to the spacecraft ahead of time and just kind of hope for the best. It's an 18 and a half minute delay. So the arm is called TAGSAM. That's the acronym, TAGSAM. And that stands for Touch and Go Sample Acquisition Mechanism. So, and that's what it is. It just touched it. It tapped the asteroid, tapped it for 6 seconds, roughly, shot some nitrogen gas out to disturb any of the ground that it would have shaken loose. All of that stuff was blown back into the little arm, the grabber. So a whole bunch of things could have gone wrong. The arm could have hit something on the ground that was too rocky, and it maybe would have just bounced back off, and they wouldn't have got samples. And that actually happened. It did hit a rock, but the arm came down with such force and the rock was brittle. So the rock actually shattered. The arm went right through a rock, I guess, and it was still able to complete its mission and gather enough sample. OSIRIS-REx is not the first spacecraft to approach and take study of an asteroid. That actually goes to a Japanese spacecraft named Hayabusa, which I talked about, ironically enough, on one of the first podcast episodes. Hayabusa had a successor named Hayabusa 2, and that one approached Yugu. That's how you pronounce it, Yugu, another asteroid. But Yugu is spelled R-Y-U-G-U. I remember practicing that. That was the first podcast episode I ever did. It was about Hayabusa 2 and Yugu. Now, the NASA team is debating whether to send OSIRIS-REx back to Bennu to take a second sample. And they're going to go to a different area. The area they went was dubbed Nightingale. They're going to pick a different area to take a sample from. And if it's too dodgy, they're going to have it come back. They're going to say, come on back to us, OSIRIS-REx. And since this is the podcast, it just reminds me of the longest distance retriever in the entire world. OSIRIS-REx is like a golden retriever out there getting a stick or a grouse or something, and it's bringing us back. And it's going to take a long time to get back to Earth. They're saying like about 2023. So I'm hoping to still do the podcast then. So I'm definitely going to update everybody in 2 years. 2 and a bit years about OSIRIS-REx's return. Now, what could they find? Well, that's the thing. They don't know. It's taking samples from outer space. So until they actually chemically analyze it on Earth and bring it back, we don't really know. They're hoping to get some advanced knowledge of how that asteroid was formed. And just by getting there and taking pictures of it, they were already getting interesting data because it didn't look like what they thought based on how it was moving and maybe where it came from. They thought it would look like, you know, a pretty smooth rock, and it turned out it was like jagged as heck. So that's the crazy thing about space. And what's so interesting about this is we're bringing a bit of space home, just like a retriever. That's science news for this week. This week in Pet Science, we're going to talk a little bit about Halloween costumes for dogs. By the time you're listening to this, it could actually be the weekend, and that's when Halloween will be next weekend. And our family loves Halloween. Of course, if you've been listening to the podcast, you know that I build elaborate costumes for my family. It is what I do for stress relief. I love it. And I build costumes for Bunsen. And when Beaker gets a little older, she'll have an elaborate one too. So for Bunsen, I've built him some battle armor. And the newest one is the Mandogalorian, or the Mandalorian Beskar armor. I built a set for Bunsen, and it's super lightweight and it's super comfortable for him. The helmet, I don't think he enjoys wearing, and he's only worn it for pictures. I think it's just a little bit too heavy. It's not like it hurts him. It's just he doesn't like it. It's not like his battle helmet, which is super, super comfortable. So why am I talking about Halloween and pets? Well, with science, with Pet Science, every Halloween, owners get themselves into dire situations by dyeing their dogs or cats or, I guess, any other pets fur, or I guess, I don't know if you're going to dye a snake. I don't think you want to do that. But anyways, if like changing the color of your pet's fur with dyes, and there have been heartbreaking situations that have occurred from humans trying to make their pets look cute and then winding up harming, hurting, or killing their pet by dyeing their hair or their fur inappropriately. Now, I have gotten flack from people online posting the pictures of Bunsen in his armor or in the Mandalorian costume. They think that he's like under duress or he's in pain. And I have slowly trained him to wear costumes. Like, he did not wear a lab coat until he was like 7 or 8 months. He didn't wear glasses until he was then, and we rewarded him with treats for every little increment of wearing different costumes. And none of the costumes are like pokey. They're all super smooth, and I pad them for comfort, especially his burner armor and the Mandalorian. It's super light. Like, it's made of 10% infilled PLA plastic from my 3D printer. So I've taken existing designs and then modified them. Some technical stuff, yada, 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 print them out at 10% infill, which means that only 10% of the plastic is filled instead of like a hard plastic, which is 100%. So it makes it somewhat breakable, but extremely lightweight. Like, it's no different than your like a dog wearing, I don't know, like a coat when it goes outside. And that's basically what it is. It's just like a plastic coat with padding. But other owners have used hair dye on their dogs or their cats with really bad results. So just remember that, like, your hair dye for humans, if it contains peroxides or other chemicals, is absolutely not appropriate for pets. Absolutely. 0% appropriate. No matter how skilled you are as a hairdresser or if you dye your own hair, that is for human hair, not for animal hair. And there's three things that can happen. The first one is it can go seep into the animal's skin. And the chemistry of a dog versus a human is crazy different, right? Burner hair can get oily, but that oil protects them. Other dogs have oily hair to make their hair waterproof. They have one or two different coats. Like, Bunsen has two different coats. Beaker has two different coats because she's a water dog. That is not how our hair works. Our hair is like one shelled, right? We don't have two different shells of hair. So there's some chemistry issues there. The second thing is that we don't lick our head. We can't lick our head. But dogs and cats groom themselves all the time, right? They're constantly licking their fur. And they can't lick the top of their head. Well, maybe Bunsen can. His tongue is freakishly long. But if you dye their arms or their shoulders or their legs or their tails, they're going to get to that and they're going to lick it and they're going to ingest it. Almost without fail, animals that have had like, if you dye an animal with human hair dye, it will have some negative consequences, from just causing itching to causing swelling to actually causing the skin of your pet underneath to start to slough off. That's what's happened to a couple dogs in different studies that have talked about dyeing your dog's hair. So should you dye your dog's hair? It's absolutely safe if you dye your dog's hair the right way for Halloween. Absolutely. Like, if you're in doubt, take your dog to a professional groomer. That groomer will have dog-specific dyes and have the right equipment to do it safely so the dog's not under duress. Most dog dyes that they use are cat dyes to spruce up your dog for Halloween are made from like food dyes that we would put in our food, because it's supernatural and it's made from like plants. It doesn't have any hard chemicals or acrid chemicals or caustic or acidic chemicals that will eat your skin. And if you talk to any dog groomer that, you know, has experience, I don't know if you can get trained as a dog groomer, but has experience, you should not be dyeing your dog every week to suit your whim. It's something that is very sporadic. So even though you're using a dye, which has no negative consequences to the dog, it's kind of like if I decided to make Bunsen wear his battle armor every single day. Like, he's not meant to wear that. Even dogs that wear coats to go outside or special training harnesses or halties or even like burners that pull carts, they only wear that harness, that specialized thing, for a few hours a day. And dyeing your pet's fur, that's something that they have to wear for a while. So the unanimous agreement is that there are safe dyes out there. They're based on food dyes that humans and dogs could eat. Right. If you think about hair dye, you're not going to go and throw that on your cornflakes and eat it. But food dye is, you know, in small amounts, occasionally, totally safe. And remember, if you're unsure and you don't know what you're doing, or if you don't know if the dye is safe for your pet, absolutely don't put it on your pet. It's insane. Go talk to a pet groomer and they'll be like, oh yeah, we've got this fun, this chalk stuff, this, we just go whitch-a-whit on their fur and oh, now you've got a pink tail. It's really cute for Halloween. You could be some My Little Pony mashup. Bunsen and Beaker are going to be the Mandalorian without his helmet, obviously, when we walk around. We're going to tie his cape up so his Mandalorian cape doesn't drag, so he's super safe that way. The armor's crazy lightweight and is really comfortable. And then Beaker's going to be Baby Yoda. I'll trim up her gown thing, her little robe. I don't know how long she'll wear the Baby Yoda helmet. Probably not very long, and that's okay. Like people last year, we didn't have Beaker last year, but last year when we walked around with Bunsen, he was Ghost Bunsen. He was a Ghostbuster. And it was literally like a human costume that, because he's so big, it's an adult human Ghostbusters costume that I cut the back end out of for his tail. And then he had a little proton pack and people thought he was adorable and he was totally comfortable wearing the jumpsuit because it was all, you know, I modified it for his body and it's just like wearing a coat. And he was only wearing it for about an hour. He got a lot of treats when we went from door to door. Sometimes I think he got people inside were more happy to see him than outside. Now, all of this could be moot. This is pet science, but we're not sure if trick-or-treating is going to be allowed in Alberta. We're waiting to see what will happen with coronavirus. I know in different parts of Canada, the municipalities have either said, you know, it's not really advised to go trick-or-treating, or they're straight out outlawed it as, you know, it's unsafe. If there is trick-or-treating for Halloween or if there isn't, we've all learned something this week in pet science. Hi, science enthusiasts. If you've been listening to the podcast and you really enjoy the content, consider signing up as a patron on our Patreon page. The podcast isn't free to produce, and our patrons make everything so much easier and even possible. We have many tiers of support. If you head over to www.patreon.com/Bunsen Burner, you can see all the cool perks each different level gets. Patrons get patron-only content, early pictures of Bunsen, insight into running the podcast, shoutouts at the end, and really cool swag. Consider signing up to support the show. The other way you can support the show is to head over to the Bunsen website. There you'll find all manner of adorable merch and limited quantities of the Bunsen stuffy. They may be sold out by the time you listen to this. We use the proceeds of that to help promote the podcast, increase equipment, and push content of science, empathy, and cuteness everywhere. You'll find the link to the Patreon page and the website in the show notes. Thanks for listening. Now on to the interviews. It's time for Ask an Expert on the Science Podcast, and I am thrilled to have Daniel Bush with me today. How are you doing today, Danielle?
I'm doing well. I'm doing pretty good.
Your classification, your job title, you're not in the lab right now, but you're a chemist.
Yes. Yep. I studied chemistry for many, many years, so even though I'm not in the lab, I'm holding on to that.
That's awesome. We'll get to that in a second. The other thing we ask our guests about is, like, where in the world are you calling into the podcast from?
I am from Chicago, Illinois.
All right. Cool. And the other thing that kind of has tied everybody together lately is coronavirus. Is you and your family doing okay with coronavirus?
Yeah, we're doing okay. Thankfully, my family, we live close to each other. So we've been able to kind of, you know, quarantine separately. But because we're quarantined separately, we know that, you know, we're clean and everything. So we can get together once a week. And we still get together on Sundays and still have dinner with each other and everything else so that we can still hold on to whatever's left of our sanity.
So you've made like a mini cohort together, hey?
Yeah, exactly.
So Yeah.
Yeah, because my brother and my mom both work from home, and so we can all, you know, stay pretty. We pretty much know that we're not exposed to others, so we're not carrying the virus back and forth.
My wife's teaching from home right now, but before I went back into the classroom in September, I was able to like hang out with my parents a little bit more. But now that I'm with, you know, hundreds of kids every day, I just don't think I'm a safe person to hang around in person. So a lot of families are doing that mini cohorting in Canada, actually, where they make a pod just so they can still have social interactions, and then they isolate separately. So that's really cool that you're an example of that.
Yeah. my family has been close all my life, so that was a requirement when it happened. My mom was saying that this is an excuse. You guys are still coming over every week. So.
I love it. So let's get back to science and chemistry. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about your training in chemistry? Like, where did you what exactly did you go to school for? What's your education there?
So I went to school initially for forensic chemistry.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah, I wanted to go into forensic science specifically. As the actual scientific person that you see on CSI, although I'm not even going to talk about how much I hate that show. But that was my initial plan. I actually ran into some health issues and couldn't graduate from that school. I had to go and kind of come home and take care of myself. But after that, I went back and finished. And since I had such a strong background in the forensic chemistry already, I just went just general forensic science because the other school I went to didn't have the very specific forensic chemistry. So my degree is actually in forensic science.
I know the CSI science person is like, it's a bunch of hooey. It's like almost, it's like 5% science and 95% magic.
Exactly.
But is that why you wanted to get into forensic chemistry or forensic science? Is you saw those shows and you're like, I want to be that person to help in the world? Or I'm just curious.
No, actually, I got into it because I would read the stories of people who were in prison for, 30 years,
30
years, and then they got, then they open up the case again, or they finally process the DNA, and it exonerates that person who's been in prison for, 40 years, and they release the person, and, with an apology, and they might get that person a stipend, but, if you think about from that person's perspective, their life is pretty much over. They've been in prison for 40 years, and with the world changing as fast as it is, what can a person who has been out of society for 40 years, what can they, legitimately do coming back into a world that is completely different than the one that they left? So I wanted to get into forensic science to make sure that, or to do what I can to help that person not go to prison in the first place.
So your reason is way more noble than what I thought. That's really cool.
I mean, it didn't end up working out. Getting into forensic science is a lot harder than people might think it is. But yeah, that was my reasoning behind it, is because, in my mind, that saying is really hits home about, you'd rather 100 guilty people go free than one innocent person get put in prison. And that's, that's what it is for me. Mm-hmm. I can't even imagine how it would be for that person who got released. Like, yeah, you're free and congratulations, it's off of your record. You're not a murderer, but for all this time, everyone, including your family, thought that you were. So I wanted to make sure that no one experienced that.
And then have the government or the state or the city just say, yeah, sorry about that.
Right. They say sorry. They'll give you, most times they'll give you a check, and it's I don't know what that price is, but I can't imagine that it's enough. If you think about a person, maybe they had a kid,
newborn
kid when they went to prison, and then 30 years later, their kid is grown, married, and now they missed all of that. For something that they never did.
From your training in this program and the science that you've taken in the chemistry, do you have any kind of stories you could share with us that you found were interesting or exciting?
I think it was an interesting class that I took. It's one of those that you have to understand what you're looking for. So I took this class, and one of the units was about drugs. And how to detect, how cops would go around and detecting like grow labs or meth labs and stuff. So they tell you the signs to look for. And so the one unit we focused on marijuana. And so basically that entire unit, my professor taught us how to grow and take care of marijuana plants in our household.
Oh,
because because the way he was saying it is like, you have to look, you have to know what you're looking for.
And that's so you true. Have to
know what they do. So he was telling us what people do and how to do it. So yeah, I always laugh at the fact that I fundamentally know how to grow marijuana in my basement.
And that's a whole nother subject too, because Canada just decriminalized and made marijuana legal. I think it's been on the books for about a year now. But I know in the States, most of the states, it's like, pretty illegal, right? Like it's a big deal if you have it, kind of thing.
Yeah, some places it is getting slow. It is slowly becoming decriminalized. Illinois did decriminalize in January. So,
oh, okay, so yeah.
Technically, if I really wanted to, it's not 100% illegal, but not what I'm interested in. But yeah,
no, yeah, yeah. That's interesting because I guess from I'm going to be a forensic investigator. Part of that probably is like where people would buy the ingredients to keep their plants alive. I never even thought of that, right? And if you know that, you would know where people would shop and receipts, yep. It's like a giant puzzle, right?
Yeah, and then also like different lighting because
uses different.
Yeah, because you have to like electricity spike, for instance, if someone suddenly starts using like twice or three times as much energy as they were using before, that's a red flag. Or if they're buying, a ton of different kind of light bulbs, because like you have your different light bulbs that you use in your house, most times you don't even think about it. But if you're using it to grow certain plants, like the fluorescent white lights won't work. You might need a yellow bulb or something like that. And so, yeah, if you see someone buying, boxes and boxes of yellow bulbs, it's like, okay, wait, what are you doing?
That's funny. I'll share a really hilarious story. Two years ago, I got a government grant for a school, and we have these, they're grow towers that grow different non-fruiting vegetables or herbs. So they're it's really cool. We put them up in all the classrooms, and they're huge. They're like as big as a person, and they're vertical. So they're hydroponic, and the kids love them because they'd pick the seeds, they'd grow the seeds, and then we would have like a salad party after like three months. We'd eat what we grew, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and even for high school kids, they all got into it. Like even these like sleepy 17-year-old kids got really excited about what we were growing in the grow tower. But the problem was is it used a ton of electricity because we had like four or five grow towers in our department. And there were some questions being asked, like, what's going on? What are you doing? So maybe they were a little suspicious as all why all of a sudden we had this massive electrical spike while the grow towers were on.
Exactly. Yep. That's what my professor was saying, is that was the first red flags. It's like if you have such a huge energy spike.
It's a 3D printer. My 3D printer uses a ton of electricity.
Oh, I would imagine so. Yeah, because those things take forever to finish something, don't they? I know, like when you were printing Bunsen's armor, like those things would take like days to print out, wouldn't it?
Yeah, his whole armor took about a week. And it goes around the clock. And the main thing is the electricity to the heated bed. So it gets kind of technical, but the bed that it prints on has to be hot, so the plastic sticks. Mm-hmm. It's like running, I don't know, like an electric blanket around the clock. And everybody who's had to use an electric blanket knows that if you run that around the clock, it uses a lot of electricity, like a space heater. Yeah.
Yep.
So from chemistry, now you have a baking company. Is that correct?
Yes. It's called Danny's Decadent Desserts. And, from my perspective, my job really hasn't changed. Honestly, it's just now I can eat my science.
Okay, so I've got so many questions because one of the main reasons I want to talk to you is there's a lot of science and chemistry that goes into baking and passion too, right? Like you have to love what you're doing to get up at the crack of dawn to get your baking done.
Yeah, definitely. although I'll admit the orders haven't been running in to the point where I have to get up at the crack of dawn yet.
Oh, I gotcha. Gotcha. But so you do have a baking company. Could you tell everybody a little bit about it? I'd love to know.
Sure. So I've actually been baking for years now. And, you know, the, that whole everyone tells you, oh, this is so good, you should try selling it. And you, no. Yeah, I decided to start trying to sell my stuff. So, but yeah, it's I've always had a passion for baking. I think it does span from my scientific background that I love seeing and understanding how things work. And baking is no different. So it's just a new way to kind of bring my passion out. And like I said, now I can eat it. So, so I got started in my kitchen. This is a home bakery. I do everything at home. I have all my own recipes. Everything is homemade. You know, from the crust that I make it myself. I rest it in my own refrigerator. I roll it out with a rolling pin. Everything is with my own two hands.
That's awesome. And just so the listeners at home can kind of get an idea, because podcast is audio, it's not smell-o-vision or taste-o-vision. Danielle sent our family these little samplers of the cobbler that you make, the four different flavors. Mm-hmm. And they were delicious. They were so good. The peach one was to die for. It was so good.
Yep. So, those are called the cobbler cups, and they are available on my website. What I sent you was our sampler pack. So it's four different flavors. It's cherry, cobbler, peach, blueberry, and blackberry cobblers. And you know, I try to make sure that everything is 100% fresh. You know, I go to the store to get my own cherries, blackberries, blueberries, peaches, all of that. I cook them, I cut them up myself. Everything is fresh. And the peach cobbler, that's an old family recipe. Got it from my grandmother, passed it down to my father, and I may or may not have stolen it from him.
I love it. That's great. Man, that's so cool that recipes like that, they're like a part of living history, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely. My family is Southern. On my dad's side, we're from Mississippi. So it's, everyone has in the South, everyone has their own family recipe for something, for some Southern dish. If it's biscuits, if it's, you know, peach cobbler, even if it's like a special thing that you do for lemonade, like everyone has a Southern, you know, everyone's family has a Southern dish that is like, my family makes this the best.
That's amazing.
We have our peach cobbler.
There you go. It's so good. It's interesting that you mentioned recipes were passed down, because my grandmother, she died a while back, but she had a recipe for like three things that is like spread to all of the grandkids. And it's like classic Canadian baking. So it's like these things that Canada has called butter tarts, that are just like so good. I can never make them as good as she made them though. So I've got to keep practicing.
You know, that's exactly how my biscuits came out. My grandmother and my aunt made just amazing biscuits, and I did exactly what my aunt told me to do, and yet they were not the same. I think she held something back from me, honestly.
Kind of the follow-up question I was going to ask, because of your background in chemistry and science, how does that impact your baking? How does that kind of like impact the things you do with your baking company?
You know, I think that it makes it, because I'm not sure if you've had a chance to visit my website, but I actually talk about in my intro that's one of the things that kind of makes my baking more authentic, I think, that, you know, I can understand what's going on and talk about it. And, you know, and it's like, you can hear the passion when I talk about both, you know, science and baking, because like I actually started, on my business Facebook page, I've actually started something called the Spice of the Day, where I,
talk, oh, cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Where I talk, you know, I pick a spice. I actually just started it on October 1st. So it's just been two of them so far. I haven't done the one for today yet. So I pick a spice and just talk about like the origins of it and how it's used. And, you know, specifically the how it's used part is kind of where I think my science background and my baking passion really kind of meet, because it's, I can tell you exactly why, you know, every, like all the food has salt in it, you know, and it's not to make it taste salty, because if you taste the salt, you've put too much in there. But, you know, I can tell you the science behind it. And so, and also that, so that to me makes baking a little easier, because I can almost, I don't necessarily have to stare at the recipe to know that it's like,
okay, oh,
I know, you know, I know if I'm making cookies, I need a leavener. So it's, you know, I need to put baking, I need to go grab the baking soda. Like if I'm, when I'm making my, my crust, for instance, you know, I know that the science behind folding the butter in and making sure the butter is ice cold, you know, that's going to mess with the, that's going to increase or decrease, or, you know, give me a flakier texture or gummier textures, you know. So it's one of those things that I can understand. It's like, okay, you know, I know what comes next because I know what this needs.
I gotcha. So instead of just kind of memorizing it to memorize it, you, when you see it, you're like, you're understanding kind of the almost the chemical interactions of the food. That's super cool.
Yeah. And it's so funny when I try and explain to someone else, cause they look at me like I'm crazy, but like, that's just, that's how my brain works. It's not, I don't need to know that it's, I need a teaspoon of baking soda just because I need a teaspoon of baking soda. It's like, no, it's because this, you know, this needs to happen on a molecular level.
I love it. So cool. Why do you put salt in cookies?
Really, it's because it's a flavor enhancer. So it actually has nothing to do with making the cookie, you know, salty. Because, you know, if you bite into a cookie, unless it's like salted caramel, for instance, because that, you know, that's actually, you're trying to get that, activate that on your tongue. But short of that, it's just, it's a flavor enhancer. It makes, like your chocolate chip cookie, for instance, the way, mm-hmm. The way the salt plays with chocolate, it basically enhances that flavor. So it makes your chocolate taste more chocolate.
Oh, see, I always wondered that. I'm like, why do these recipes for sweet stuff call for salt?
And because if you think about how much salt you're putting in there, usually it's a half a teaspoon, maybe
it's not much, right?
Right. It's never enough that it's like, okay, I'm putting salt in there because I need it to be salty. No, because yeah. Like you're putting a half a teaspoon in, you know, and you put in like 4 cups of flour, a half a teaspoon of salt isn't going to do anything. But it the way it works on a molecular level.
That's so cool. Well, you know what? Now I have a more understanding and appreciation for somebody who's got the recipe with salt in it. I think I've actually made, I'm like, why has this got salt? We don't need that. So maybe that whatever I cook tastes, maybe that's the difference in the butter tarts.
You left out the salt? Yeah, that's a bad move.
Ah, okay. Well, that's good. I'm glad I've talked to you. I'm glad I talked to you. Let's take a little bit of a right turn here. Okay. We always ask our guests for stories about pets. This is the Science Podcast, after all. Could you tell us a pet story from your life?
Ooh, pet story. I have plenty of them. I've actually had dogs all of my life. My parents got my brother, my brother is 6 years older than me, and for his 6th birthday, they got him a puppy. And so when he got the puppy, you know, I was like 3 or 4 months old at that point. So they had a puppy and a baby in the house at the same time. But
ooh, busy.
Right. But that was like my first dog, and I've had a dog all of my life since that moment. So I have two of them now, Duke and Zeus. They are insane. one of the things I love about them is that they are they're part Beagle and part Terrier. I got them from shelters, so I don't know, you know, 100% of what's mm-hmm. going on in there, but yeah, they have Beagle and Terrier in them. So when they see something, you know, going on outside or whatever, the Beagle part of them wants to howl and bay, but the Terrier part of them can't get low enough on the tone to make it sound like a bay of a regular beagle. So it's like this high-pitched yelling. And it's the funniest thing to hear them howl like they're like howler monkeys almost. It's like that. pitch. So the first time they did it, I almost fell out of my chair laughing.
It's like it's ingrained in them, but it's not coming out the right way.
Exactly. It's like they the beagle part of them says how. The terrier part of them says how high.
That's hilarious.
And then they always trigger each other because one will – they never see whatever it is because usually it's, you know, it's something that happens like really quickly, like a squirrel runs by the window or whatever. So both of them rarely know what they're howling at. But one starts and then the other one has to join in.
That's hilarious. Bunsen and Beaker do that too. Bunsen is a good watchdog, so he has a room and he looks out the window and he'll bark like to warn everybody something, you know, there's something. And by the time you go over there, I'm like, what is going on? And Beaker's over there like, what? And then sometimes she'll like be barking, but in out the wrong window. She just wants to be part of the experience, I think. Because she's a golden retriever. She's just a goofball.
That's how it is when I go over my parents' house. My mom has a dog too. And that's exactly how it is when, because they have that pack mentality too. And it doesn't matter whatever window or whoever starts it. It's if one is barking, all three are barking.
Silly dogs. I can imagine though that they, during the quarantine, they've really helped with your mental health.
100%. Yeah. When I was in college, you know, I actually did struggle with anxiety and depression. And so both of my dogs actually are, I got them, you know, a course online that got them certified as, you know, sport animals.
Sport animals. Yeah.
And, you know, obviously they're not the kind, they're not, you know, the kinds you take to restaurants and anything like that. Like they don't have vests or anything, but, you know, I sat down with a therapist and, you know, talked about having them with me and everything. And she's like, yeah, that's a good idea to have dogs, you know, your support dogs like that. So, yes, they have helped me tremendously.
Oh, that's so good. That's awesome. I'm glad to hear that.
Definitely, because, yeah, they don't. And then, you know, obviously, you know, having dogs doesn't allow you to be, you know, a sedentary lifestyle at all anyway.
Nope.
I have a backyard. I let them out. It's a fenced in backyard. I let them out and I let them run around. But a lot of times that's just not enough. They're like, no, it's time to go for a walk or go to dog parks that we'll go visit.
Aw, cute.
Yeah, take them off leash and just let them run.
That's a great joy in my day. One of my favorite parts of my day every day is just letting the dogs go explore. I'm very privileged where I live. Like we live on a farm with like tons and tons of open space behind us. But just watching their expressions as they explore the world, even when we do take them to a dog park or just walking on leash too in town, it's just a fantastic way to end your day. Or just if you start your day that way, I'd imagine that would be a great way to start your day.
Yeah. And actually funniest thing too is it helped me when I moved because I've been in my house currently for a little over a year now. And when I first moved, you know, just to know the neighborhood, I would, you know, put them on their leashes and we would just go walking.
Oh, yeah.
And that helps me, you know, find, okay, well, that's, you know, that's where the city hall is. And that's okay. That's another park that we can come visit later on. And so, you know, just walking helps to explore the neighborhood, too.
Ah, I never even thought of that. That's super cool.
It was the funniest thing for the first like 2 weeks. I would text my mom and say, hey, I just found this over here. And she's like, wait, I didn't even know that. Because my brother actually lives in the same town with me. So, you know, we've been to this town before. But there's some things that I've found walking that we just never knew about. And I would text my mom and say, hey, I found this just out walking with the dogs.
And that's not something that the average, you know, you think about if you don't have a dog or you may not make those same choices to be out in the same way. So yeah, it gives you a different experience of life. Thanks for sharing your pet story, Danielle.
Of course.
The next question I have for you is the super fact. It's something that you know that when you tell people, it kind of blows their mind. It could be a story or a fact. Do you have a super fact you could share with us?
For anyone who knows anything about me, they know I am a really big football fan, American football. Mm-hmm. I'm a huge, huge, huge Bears fan. Like, I've actually met a couple of different players, got their autographs. I got, you know, autographed jerseys and footballs and things like
that. Oh, cool.
Yeah. So one time, this was back in college, me and my girlfriends were talking, and you know, we were just kind of joking around, and I said that one of my friends couldn't name two football teams, you know, just in the league. And she surprised me by naming two of them. And then she came back at me and she was like, you have to name all 32 of them and the cities that they play in. I was like, okay. Took me a while, but I did it.
that's how many teams are in the NFL?
There's 32.
There's 32. Oh my goodness.
So yeah. And I mean, you know, if you think about it, you can generally name, like, just kind of run, if you just want to think about, you know, any kind of thing that you know about. It's like, oh yeah, I can name that easily. I can easily name 32. And then it's like, once you start thinking about it, it's like, oh wait. Going by, because it was like, okay, I got to figure out how to do this. And so I was like, okay, I'll go by cities. It was a little difficult for a while there.
Canada has the CFL, right? The Canadian Football League.
Yeah.
I don't know how many teams. I would be hard pressed to tell you how many teams. There's not very many. There's like 9 or maybe 11 or something like that. But we get a lot of our media has references to the NFL, and there's a lot of NFL fans in Canada. I don't watch the NFL, but I have, I know two NFL teams just from teaching kids. So, the kids bug me all the time that I look like this quarterback, for the Green Bay Packers, Aaron Rodgers. So, like, there's a group of kids about 2 years ago that constantly were making Aaron Rodgers memes. And because I don't watch the NFL, I didn't know who this guy was. I had no idea who this guy was. And then, so they were sending me Aaron Rodgers memes. And when he was having a good game, they would text me or like send me an Instagram message through my school account saying, like, hey, good game, or like, why'd you fumble the ball? Or when he got hurt, they'd send me injury reports like, hey, you should be doing this for rehab. So it was really. It was really funny. And then they gave me this parting gift, which is on my closet in the room. Sometimes you can see it in behind Bunsen pictures I take, is this full color picture of Aaron Rodgers they gave me. So now, is he like a direct competitor to your Chicago Bears? Like, is there a rival?
Okay,
so you hate this guy, right? Like, he's like a villain to you, right? Because you love your Bears.
100%, yeah. because actually,
that's funny.
The Bears and the Packers are two of the older teams just in the league, just in general. Because last year the NFL actually celebrated 100 years. You know, that the NFL has been around for 100 years, and the Bears and the Packers both are 100-year teams.
Really?
So,
wow.
So not only are we rivals because we play in the same division, but we're rivals because we've been rivals since the very beginning. And so, yes, it is actually when Bears fans, or, you know, when a baby is born into a Bears fan or a Packers fan family, that is something that is taught from birth.
It's like an identity.
You are to hate the Packers. That is your, whatever you want to be in life. You can do whatever you want to do, but you're going to be a Bears fan and you're going to hate the Packers.
It's like the Toronto Maple Leafs in Canada. There's diehard Toronto Maple Leaf fans in the hockey league. That's funny. Similar.
Yeah. And I mean, we have, because there's four teams in our division, and so we have hate for the other two teams as well, but they are, I mean, newer relatively. Again, you know, it's 100 years. It's not like they're brand new teams, but
yeah.
But the Lions and the Vikings are the other two teams in our division, and so they weren't there from the very beginning. So the hate doesn't run as deep.
This is great. I'm getting educated about baking and also NFL football. This is amazing.
Oh yeah, I'm full of random things.
That's great. And then, of course, the other team that I know about, it's because I'm such a huge fan of The Good Place, is the Jacksonville Jaguars, or because of Jason on on The Good Place with Blake Bortles. Apparently they're a trash team, like they're not very good, but he always cheers for them. I don't know, but it's just I think that's really funny.
They actually, and it's so, it's really funny to actually watch, because I watch that show too, and it's really funny to watch that because he's so far behind. I mean, obviously, since he's dead.
Right. Yeah. So he thinks, he's thinking like 7 years ago kind of thing.
Right. Like Blake Bortles doesn't play on the team anymore.
He doesn't?
That's funny. Jacksonville has gotten better, like in the past like 2 years. They're actually a pretty good team. And so, yeah, being a football fan, watching that show is actually kind of hilarious.
That's great. I love it.
I'm surprised. I thought you were actually going to say that you also know about Detroit, because when my father and I took him to Detroit game, they were playing the Bears, and I took him for Christmas 2 years ago. That was his Christmas present. And we were sitting in a row with like probably like 8 or 9 people from Canada. And they said that they're season ticket holders, and they just, easy to go to Detroit, and they just crossed the border just to watch the game and then go back.
Yeah. No, like there's a lot of NFL fans in Canada. Where I live, a drive to get to the nearest NFL football game would be like a 20-hour drive, though. So like we are really far away. Well, it would be like something, I think Seattle would be the close. Is it the Seahawks? Seahawks?
Yeah, that's the Seahawks.
Yeah, that would be the closest drive for us. And that's like, 20-hour drive, so it'd be faster to fly.
yeah, definitely not worth that. not worth the drive if you can, you know, get it on TV if you're that big of a fan to begin with. But yeah, no, it's not, I've never driven 20 hours to see a game.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, if we're ever on the East Coast, that's on my bucket list to go to an NFL game. So maybe a Chicago Bears. But I'll have to be careful. If I look like Aaron Rodgers, I might get beat up. I'm kind of scared.
Well, Seattle isn't as big of a rival, so if you go to Seattle game, you should be safe. But yeah, no, if you go to the Bears game, you might get heckled a little bit.
I'll wear a mask or something.
Probably safe.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, thanks for sharing your super fact. This has devolved into the most random, amazing conversation ever. So sorry, podcast listeners. Normally we talk about science, but you know what? It's 2020 and everything is kind of crazy. So here you go.
Exactly. Yep. We're living in a whole new world now.
Danielle, with the stuff you make for your baking company, what are some of the top things that people like and your favorite things to bake?
My favorite thing to bake or to make is probably my crust. Like I enjoy, just the process that goes into making a crust. It's very specific. And if you do things wrong, your crust is not going to be good, like at all. It's going to have a different texture than it's supposed to have. And so it's cool to me how very specific and kind of temperamental my crust can be. But that does tie into the what people like the most. You know, one of the things that actually kind of pushed me into selling what I make is that my dad told me that I make some of the best crust that he's ever had. You know, like when he bakes his, or when he makes his version of peach cobbler, it's usually he's using store-bought crust. And it almost frustrates him, the fact that I can make crust so he considers so easily. And so like when I sell it to you know, I'll sell it and people give me feedback and, you know, put their reviews online. The crust is usually a lot of things that people talk about is how good it is, how the texture of it is. And I've gotten to a point where I get it consistently that it's going to be the same, you know, if I make it today or if I make it, you know, next month, it's going to be the same. So that's probably one of my favorite things to make. And it's a hot seller. My blueberry cobbler and my peach cobbler cups are probably my best sellers.
The last section is really fun. And it's also usually leads to some good discussions. It's the last question or the last sections about something that's important to the guest. Other guests have talked about causes or even tattoos or video games. And you wanted to talk about the Black Lives Matter movement and maybe how people who are not necessarily in the community of African Americans could educate themselves and help. Could you talk to us about that?
Sure. First and foremost, it's understanding that, you know, we call it the Black Lives Matter movement, and that's what it is. You know, it is a movement, but first and foremost, it's a statement of the fact that Black lives matter. That is the statement, you know, that the first way that, you know, our allies can help is to understand that we're not saying anything that, you know, Black lives only matter, or, you know, Black lives matter more than somebody else. It's just our statement is that Black lives matter. So, you know, that's the first thing. And then secondly is, you know, I tell people who want to ask me how I can, you know, because I've actually had people from that I went to school with ask me, you know, like, how can I support you? How can I help you? Because, you know, I'll get on Facebook sometimes, and after like Breonna Taylor, I'm not sure if you've heard about that.
Oh, no. Yeah. No, we know all about that. It's absolutely heartbreaking.
Right. So, you know, after that, you know, I might get on Facebook just to rant and, you know, blow off some frustrations, and I'll have people reach out to me, you know, what do you need? What, you know, how can we help? And it's one, reaching out, that is awesome. That is an amazing thing to do, is just reaching out, checking in on us, you know, the African American people in your life that constantly see, you know, obviously I'm only talking about America because that's where it's really most prevalent for me. Not to say that, you know, racism isn't all around the world or anything else. I'm just, from a personal standpoint, I'm talking about America.
Mm-hmm. I totally get it.
So, you know, so that's why I say first is like reaching out is a great first step, but also, you know, education. Obviously it's like you know, if you don't fall into the African American, if you don't identify that way, then you don't experience it. But, you know, it would be so helpful if people educate themselves. Like, you know, don't, you know, ask your friend, like, well, you know, I don't understand how people are being racist. Can you explain it to me? It's that in itself is a little insensitive, because like now, not only do I have to experience it, but now I have to relive it in the fact that I have to explain it to somebody else. You know, right. It's do your own research. Google exists, you know.
Okay.
Read up on there's a lot of books out there. A lot of great, you know, like The New Jim Crow is a really good book that kind of talks about experiences that African Americans go through from all the way from Jim Crow to today. And it's like, a lot of times I want to tell people, you know, read for yourself, because we appreciate the allies. We appreciate you wanting to get that education, but it's draining when, you know,
I'm so sorry. I've never even thought about that.
Right. And most people don't. And it's not to say that when people do it, it's in a malicious way. And I understand it's absolutely not. Like, a lot of people are genuinely wanting to educate themselves. And they figure that the easiest way to do that is to talk to someone who's experienced it. And yeah, that is the easiest way to do that. But it's easiest on, you know, on the person
getting
the education. It's harder on the person giving the education.
The resources are out there. Like, if you're interested enough and you care enough, go use the resources.
Right.
Don't expect someone like yourself to be the teacher all the time.
Exactly. And especially because you got to think that, you know, if one person is asking me that question, chances are one person is asking me that question. And so I don't want to have to educate, you know, an entire class full
of, it's not your job.
Exactly. And then so, you know, when, and especially since a lot of times it happens after like a major event, like I was actually at one of the George Floyd protests, and so that was a huge spark. And, you know, right after that, a lot of people were asking me questions like that, and it's like, I have, you know, I'm emotional already because of everything that's going on now. And now on top of that, I have to try and turn around and educate somebody else. And it's like, you know, I don't want to sound ungrateful because, like I said, I do appreciate the support and reaching out. But on the other hand, you know, I'm already emotionally drained. I don't want to have to go through why I'm emotionally drained.
It's so important that we've had this discussion. I think your message is going to resonate with people. Like, the resources are there.
Yep.
Go use them.
Yeah.
Like, it's, we have, yeah, everybody in their pocket has a miniature computer that has the power of humanity and the history of humanity if you just use it.
Exactly. And, you know, bigger issues is the fact that that's not something that is taught, you know, in schools. You know, when we learn about the history of America, you know, you learn that it was founded, you learn about Thanksgiving, all that stuff. But it's like, you know, the role that minorities, any minority, not just African-Americans, but the role that minorities play in the history of America is severely downplayed when it comes to educating, you know, educating for future generations. It's like, if you really, a lot of minorities get their education about their own history from home, from parents, from relatives, things like that. You know, there's very little formal education about minority history. Like, we, you know, African Americans have an entire month, but it actually ends up being, you know, the big ones. You know, obviously everyone knows about Martin Luther King, and you know about Rosa Parks. Mm. And you know about, you know, we would even get George Washington Carver thrown in. That's pretty much it. Like, even Malcolm X's role has been downplayed over the years because he wasn't the nonviolent part that Martin Luther King Jr. was. So even his stuff, and, you know, no one learns about the Black Panthers. A lot of that stuff gets taught at home to the people who, you know, to ask for it. And that's usually the African American community. Or, you know, if you're learning about Native Americans, that Native Americans learn about Native Americans, you know, because you're only learning that stuff in the home. Like, the most, if you ask a white person of my generation what the Trail of Tears is, you know, 50-50, they'll know and they won't know.
And that's a problem. That's a huge problem.
That's a huge problem. But, you know, that's not something that, you know, one person can solve. But, you know, if you think about what Hamilton, the story of Hamilton. Great, great play. I love it so much.
It's so good, isn't it?
But one of the things that, because I saw an interview with Lin-Manuel Miranda, I saw an interview with him, and he says, well, you know, some of that stuff is made up, but the cool thing about it is that it drove people to go research it for themselves.
Exactly.
See what it was that was made up and what actually happened. And so it's like that, you know, that's the kind of stuff that we need, is something that drives people to be interested, to research it for themselves.
That's such a powerful message, Danielle. Thank you. Canada has had a really dark history with our Indigenous First Nations, Métis, Inuit. I posted something on Bunsen's account about Orange Shirt Day. Like,
I saw that.
Most people don't know. Most people think of Canada as, like, you know, the friendly, polite nation. And we now, I would say we are today, but like any other, you know, expanding European country, they came in and they did horrible, unspeakable things to the people that lived here first.
Right.
We had these residential schools, and I did not know about the residential schools until I was a 30-year-old man, because it wasn't taught in school. And it was like this horrific thing where for 100 years, they would forcibly remove, Indigenous kids from their family and send them to a school to indoctrinate them, take away their culture, teach them English, teach them, you know, Christianity, a different religion than what they're used to on with their own families. And like, it's definitely the main cause of the huge amount of dysfunction after that point in the Indigenous communities around Canada. And it's now in the curriculum. Like, it is taught to kids who are in elementary school, middle school, and it's made a change. Like, it's made, you are more empathetic as a nation when you understand and you can see the pain that has been caused in the past. And if you try to hide that, nothing changes.
Right. And I also think that it really, it helps you to under, to give a more well-rounded view of not just the people around you, but of your own culture as well. You know, if you think about so many times that the hero story, you know, that someone was in need, you know, for instance, the Native Americans, you know, when the story of Thanksgiving was first kind of taught, you know, Native Americans were painted as quote unquote savages. That
yeah,
you know, that the settlers came and educated and, you know, and helped and like humanized them. And so, you know, if that's your narrative, then you see your relatives as heroes. You know, they're the ones who saved these people.
And the whole idea of the European settlers in Canada, and then you guys have Christopher Columbus, right? That's the American story. The first nations, the indigenous people, saved all of their asses. Like, they came over in Canada specifically, they landed in Canada, and the winter just about killed them all. And they were starving and they were freezing, and the indigenous people saved them. Mm-hmm. They taught them, and they had scurvy. They were dying. So, like, they led them to safety. They showed them safe places to camp.
Yep.
They taught them to boil the spruce needles to get vitamin C. Like, and that's what we're teaching kids now. So they look, it gives you a different perspective that had the indigenous people not done that, Canada would have been a very different place. And I can't even imagine trying, like, the story of the United States with African Americans is just, I can't even imagine trying to rework that, but it needs to be done, in my opinion. But I'm not an American. I can't speak for your country, but.
Oh, no, it definitely needs to be redone. And, and well, I think that is one of those things that.
Things will only improve when people become educated. Education is the number one weapon against racism, ignorance, stupidity, like all of that grossness.
Yeah.
Education is the light in the darkness.
Right. Because a lot of racism, you can almost stem to, you know, uneducation.
Such a powerful talk. It kind of went long, Danielle, but just to summarize with what you're saying, reach out and then do your best to educate yourself.
Yes.
Don't, if you want to be an ally, come to the battle educated, and don't expect the African American community to do all that work for you.
Yes, that's a very succinct way to put that. Thank you.
Well, it's been my absolute pleasure to talk to you about baking chemistry and some really deep issues. Can you throw in a plug for yourself and where people can find your baking company?
Sure. So again, the baking company's name is Danny's Decadent Desserts. My website, danny'sdecadentdesserts.com. My whole menu is available on the website. And if there's any questions, there is a section where you can reach out to me. I have Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. So Facebook and Instagram are both Danny's Decadent Desserts. Twitter is Danny's_desserts. And then so I can be reached at any of those outlets. You can see it. I'm running ads on all three platforms. I actually am going to be running a special from the podcast. So if anyone goes on my website, uses the coupon code podcast, spelled just like you spell yours.
I love it. PAWDCAST.
Yep, spelled just like that. That yep, it's going to be a buy one get one free.
Awesome!
Cups. So
we'll make sure there's a direct link in the show notes. So if you're listening and you got a hankering for some decadent desserts, you're one click away. And do you ship all over? Like you got your stuff up to us in Canada, so I'd imagine you ship all over the United States.
Yep, definitely ship all over the United States. I will admit it was a bit more complicated than I thought it was to ship to Canada.
tell me about it. We've been like sending stuffies and stickers and stuff all over the place. It is like a gong show getting stuff out of Canada.
Yeah, it was more complicated than I thought it was going to be. But yeah, I do ship all over the country.
Well, once again, thanks for talking to us on the podcast, Danielle.
Thank you so much for having me.
This was a fun chat, but also a very enlightening chat.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, you take care with your two dogs and have a great day.
All right, you too.
It's time for Woo or Wow on the Science Podcast, and I'm super excited. As a guest host, I have Tyus Williams back with me today. How are you doing today, Tyus?
Hey, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. It's nice to hear from you again. I hope you and Bunsen are doing really well during this this pandemic.
Yeah, we've been great, and we gained an extra dog too, Beaker. So
ooh,
the last time. Yeah, the last time we chatted, Tyus was a guest in season one. What have you been up to lately, Tyus?
Well, I just finished finished a seasonal field research position. I was out in Nevada, northern Nevada in Reno for 6 months. I was working with UNR as a field ecologist technician. And basically, I spent 6 months, pretty much a majority of my time camping out in the Great Basin area, and in Northern California, in some small corners of Oregon, in Northern Oregon, looking at how essentially habitat treatment and removal under the PhD student Danielle Miles. I was working under her at how habitat treatment and removal affects small mammal species and herpetal fauna. So I basically spent 6 months out there. It was really fulfilling. It was very rewarding. I got to drive cross country. I got to stop and do a lot of sightseeing. And, cool. You know, we spent 2 weeks pretty much out in the field. We would spend 2 weeks or a week at a time camping pretty much out in the Great Basin area in different areas. Just collecting data and just, you know, doing some small mammal trapping and collecting some morphometric data and doing some small ear tagging. And it was really, really rewarding. And I think it was so perfect for my mental health because the pandemic was pretty much onset. So I really needed to get out the house. And what better position to attain than being able to camp out for pretty much 6 months. You know, traveling around Western United States. So that was a very, very memorable experience. And I probably won't forget it. So, you know, after that, I just pretty much was bouncing around, visiting some family in LA and Washington. And now I'm on my way back to Georgia, just here visiting my grandmother and keeping an eye on her, making sure she's not getting into too much trouble.
Oh, well, okay. So that sounds really exciting. Now, getting all that data is obviously the science part of that is amazing. And the camping part is something, and the field research is something that not a lot of people think about. The scientists have to rough it.
Yeah, definitely.
Did you miss civilization being away from it that long? Like I've talked to other guests who've had to go, for example, to the rainforest in Southern America. Mm-hmm. Did you miss civilization or was it just your cup of tea just being out there in the wilds?
I think it was perfect for me. I'm not one of those people like when I'm deprived from social interactions, I have this this yearning to make contact again after like the first 3 days I'm out of like Wi-Fi, you know, my phone's not connecting. I think it's really good for me to recuperate and kind of I guess in a way settle with myself again and come to terms and I think find peace inside of myself because at the end of the day, it's like, it's just you. It's always you. When you go to bed, when you wake up in the morning, you're by yourself more than you realize, even if you have people around you, because it's you and your mind and your body and your spirit that you have to deal with every single day. And I think that was really good for me because we would be out there for 2 weeks and some of the areas that we would be in, we didn't have Wi-Fi or sometimes we'd get patches of, you know, cell phone signal. And sometimes it worked. Like I could send a couple of text messages. But in general, though, it wasn't like we were truly, I would say, off the grid. You know, we were maybe like an hour and a half away from like people if we really were in an emergency situation. So, you know, we were roughing it, but I wouldn't say it was like such a tremendously extreme situation where like, you know, we're 300 miles outside of like the nearest city and like nobody is going to be able to help us in time if somebody finds themselves in a, you know, a potentially fatal, you know, emergency situation or something like that.
Gotcha. But, yeah. Yeah. I tell you, it's, we're so close to the mountains where we live in Alberta, Canada. Mm-hmm. And it's just good for your soul to get out in nature and you just stand there and you look at all of that around you and, you know, it does recharge your batteries for sure.
It centers you. That's the word I was looking for.
I'm going to steal that.
It centers you. And I feel like that's how it is. It's nature in wild spaces are definitely my sanctum. And I find the peace inside of myself kind of realigning again when I'm out there. And so it's very good for me, doing a lot of photography and taking a lot of notes and doing a lot of poetry. And I think it's really good for me. So I wasn't bothered the least bit. I think the funniest thing for me was like, we go 2 weeks, you know, with no internet connection. And there's this one particular area called the Sheldon Wildlife Refuge. And it's, they originally called it the National Antelope Wildlife Refuge because the pronghorn are on there, and pronghorn aren't antelope, but I guess they historically called them that. There's a cabin in the area that you can stay in. And it's like such a quaint and adorable house that you can stay in and you have no cell phone, you know, connection. And there's just books and natural history books and field guide books and all sorts of things. There's ground squirrels running around the burrows outside of the house. You can hear them calling in the morning. There's red-tailed hawks, you know, a nest not too far off from the house. Like there's so much wildlife just, completely coexisting with you in that exact space. And it was very, it was very therapeutic for me. But then you leave and you get cell phone connection and then you're like, oh, Kanye's running for president. And you're like, oh, can we go back to the cabin? Because I don't want to deal with this right now.
Yeah, you get all the crazy stuff.
Your phone just starts blowing up. And you're just like, You're like,
some poor sucker's been living in the woods since like January. And they just come back now. And the world
exactly. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. It's crazy. It's insane. It's like the news just starts blowing up your phone. You're like, all right, what's going on now?
Well, let's stick to something that's a little bit more fun than some of the grouchy news that happens. And that's the Woo or Wow. You're here as a guest host to try and do some Woo or Wow. Woo or Wow on the podcast for Tyus, as a reminder, and for people that are listening, I read three statements and only one of them is true. You've got to try and find the true statement. So it's a bit of a trivia game.
Okay.
Make sense, Tyus?
Yes.
All right. Danielle Bush was the guest this week and she is a chemist and a baker. So the category this week is food, science and food.
Okay.
All right. Are you a fan of food?
I love cooking. I was going to say, it was like some gastronomy. I was like, I can dig that. I was like, let's do it. Like some food science.
Do you have a favorite dish you cook, Tyus?
I'm actually really good at making curry, actually.
No way.
I
adore curry. It is so good.
It's definitely one of my favorite things to make. My grandmother just taught me how to make gumbo from scratch. It's all about the roux. So I'm not much of a baker. I'm trying to become a better baker, but I'm way more, I would say, experienced in the actual the practice of cooking itself.
Oh, that's cool. That's awesome. I love stir fry.
Oh, me too.
And stir fry and curry. Well, they're different, but curry's so good.
Yeah, Latin and Asian foods are my staples.
Oh, man, I don't know. Yeah, you know, we have a couple good Canadian, quote-unquote Canadian-type foods, but I tell you that, Latin and Asian food just blows that out of the water. So, all right, you ready to start?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so don't guess till the end. If you want to riff on any of the factoids or fake-toids, then go right ahead.
Okay.
Statement number one, wine is one of the only vegan alcoholic beverages.
That's false.
Oh, you think so? Okay. Well, let's go to the second statement. You're pretty sure about that one. Canadians and Americans get their vast majority of daily antioxidants from bananas. Do you want me to go to the third statement?
Yeah.
Okay. The early recipes for pound cake were exactly 1 pound of all of the ingredients that made it. 1 pound of butter, 1 pound of eggs, and 1 pound of sugar. Pretty sure about that first statement being false. Okay.
Yeah. Let's see.
Do you want me to recap or are you good?
I'm trying to think. I'm getting basically the second one was that Canadians and Americans get majority of their antioxidants from bananas, you said, right?
From bananas, yeah.
And then the third was the
original recipe for pound cake called for 1 pound of butter, 1 pound of eggs, and 1 pound of sugar.
Well, I'm trying to wrap my head around it because my grandmother makes pound cake, and I thought I understood historically that the reason why it was called pound cake is because after it was done, it weighed about a pound. So the ingredients in combination caused for it to like weigh a pound. And I'm trying to think. And it's hard for me to believe that most of the antioxidants that Canadians and Americans get are from bananas. If anything, I would say that most Americans are probably getting their antioxidants probably from beer. And so I'm going to say that statement one and two are false, and then statement three is true.
Okay, final answer, Tyus?
Yes.
Okay, so we'll take a look at that first statement. You were pretty sure that one was false. Wine is one of the only vegan alcoholic beverages. You're right, that one is not true.
Yes.
A lot of wine is not vegan, and not very many people know that unless you've checked the ingredients.
Right.
Some wines have milk protein, egg whites, gelatin, and fish bladder protein.
Right. And also technically, that's true. The fish bladder protein and egg whites and milk proteins and I was just thinking too, because it's like beer is also vegan, and I was like, well, I was like wine can't be the only one, so I was like, that has to be false. So that's cool. I didn't know that. I didn't know the fish proteins. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I didn't know that either till I looked it up. My wife is a lacto-ovo vegetarian, so she's okay. I don't know about the fish stuff though. So she loves wine. So I guess we'll have to really be careful with the different types of wine we get. All right. So we're down to two statements. One's about antioxidants and the other's about pound cake. Which one do you want to hear first, Tyus?
Let's do the antioxidants.
All right. So if that means if this is false, you win.
Okay.
Okay. Americans and Canadians get the vast majority of their daily antioxidants from coffee. So you've won. Good job, Tyus.
Yes, I got it.
Well done.
I can finally rest in peace now.
So I found that shocking, but if you think about the amount of coffee that North Americans drink,
yes.
Canadians and Americans don't differ too much in how much coffee we do
yes,
drink.
Exactly.
There's not a lot of antioxidants in coffee relative
to,
say,
more coffee than they are eating bananas.
This is 100% true. We're drinking more coffee than all of the antioxidants combined from what we get from fruits and vegetables, which is kind of sad.
Oh, for sure.
You know what?
Sure.
I do drink like two or three cups of coffee easy a day.
Yeah. I've started to adjust my behavior with coffee. I drink a lot more matcha now, and matcha has half the caffeine than regular coffee grounds. And so it's a lot better.
There you go. Yeah. So it depends really on your tolerance for caffeine. I've got a really high tolerance for caffeine.
Not me.
And I wouldn't be a true Canadian if I didn't drink Tim Hortons coffee, because that's the big coffee chain up here with
You said Tim Hortons? You
know, Tim Hortons, yeah. And not if you're from Southern America, you maybe have never heard of Tim Hortons before.
I've heard of Tim Hortons before. I didn't realize that it was a staple in Canada.
Oh, like it's as Canadian as hockey is. So,
oh, that's funny. Yeah, I can hear you when you say the yeah. You're like, oh yeah, yeah. It's Tim Hortons. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, we got into a big fight on Bunsen's account, quote unquote fight. It was a friendly fight. Because we call donut holes Timbits. Because
oh,
that's
really?
Right. So we never. If you like, unless you knew in the United States they were called donut holes,
okay,
you would have no concept of what somebody was talking about when they said donut holes. You'd be like, what? And then you show them, somebody would show you a donut hole and be like, oh, that's a Timbit.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing, right? So
yeah.
there's a big fight on Twitter between Timbits and
I was,
donut holes.
When was it? It was, I think there was a tweet on Twitter months back, and it was talking about like Canadian staples and Canadian just novel items that a lot of people actually consumed regularly that they didn't realize was American. Or I think I was talking about it, but I remember I was tweeting that like I used to drink bagged milk when I was in elementary school and when I was in California. I loved bagged milk. People didn't understand it. They were like,
no,
why? Like, why did you drink milk out of a bag? Like, I don't know. I was like, that's just how it was. That's what they served to us when we went to the cafeteria, like in elementary school. It was bagged milk. I didn't know that it was Canadian, but I liked it. I thought it was cool, you know?
That's a weird thing. That's an Eastern Canadian thing. So once you hit Ontario, milk goes into a bag. So we have jug milk or carton milk in Alberta and Western Canada.
Right.
Or if you're close to a farm, it's in a glass, you know, fresh from the cow kind of thing.
Yeah.
We have a lot of dairy farms around here. Yeah. Isn't that funny? Bag milk. Hey. So just to finish off, you're right. It is, you're right. Or your guess was correct. originally it was 1 pound of each ingredient to make pound cake.
Okay.
And that history has changed over time to now the final weight. You are right. The final weight is the colloquially it weighs 1 pound.
Hey.
But originally it was 1 pound of each. And that would make a giant cake.
Yeah. So that's humongous.
Yeah, giant pound cake. But it, you know, you think back then, the only people that would have that kind of ingredients would be big bakeries, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, your local peasants wouldn't be walking around with that much butter or eggs.
No, there's definitely, you don't have serfdoms making a pound cake, you know, on the weekends.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, oh, you know, gather the fellas together. I'm just making some pound cake. You know, just got a pound of butter and milk at my disposal.
It'd feed the whole village for a week.
Yeah, exactly. Unfortunately, that's not exactly how it worked in those communities.
No, it didn't. Well, you know what? It's been so fun to catch up with you, Tyus. I wish I could talk to you more about your adventures. We're WoW, sadly, is a really short section, so we've got to say goodbye. And
this was
congratulations
fun.
Congratulations on winning. You're actually the first guest from season one. I'm going to be trying to have some back for We're WoW. So you've started off at 100%.
Hey, I'm setting the bar. Let's go.
Yeah, the bar's high. That was a tough We're WoW too, Tyus.
Yeah, that was really good. I liked that. That was really interesting. You know, it's just the antioxidant question was so funny to me because I was just like, there's no way most Canadians and Americans are getting their antioxidants from bananas. I was like, they're getting it from beer way before they get it from bananas. I was like, yeah. You both know this. And I was like, and blueberries are probably come in second after bananas. But I was like, no way. I was like, the amount of beer that people drink in this country, I was like, no way. So
blueberries and blackberries are crazy rare in Canada too. Like they only grow
exactly
in Western Canada and like out of season. They're like, you have to give up your second child for a little tin of them. They're so expensive.
Jason, thanks so much for having me on. This was actually very stimulating and I really enjoyed the conversation with you. Let me know how the other contestants fare in this bout of Woo and WoW.
Okay. Well, you take care, Tyus. Have yourself a great day.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks so much. And say hi and give a pat on the head to Bunsen and Beaker for me.
Okay. It's time for Mailbag. Adam.
Yeah, it's mailbag time. If you don't know what the mailbag is, because we haven't done it in a while. We haven't done mailbag in a while. I'm excited. Mailbag. How this works is you guys ask us questions on Twitter and we answer them. So the first question is coming from Woodworkin. Favorite treats for Bunsen, Beaker, and humans. Mom, would you like to answer this question?
I sure would. This is my question to answer. So for the favorite treats for Bunsen, he really likes these freeze-dried sardines. He just really, really enjoys them. They have a high scent, and they're really motivating for him. As for Beaker, she pretty much likes anything. She's a retriever after all. Although we were training last Saturday and I had some treats in my pocket. They were suggested to bring treats and a mix of kibble and things like that. But I had these treats that she really liked as a puppy and they're like freeze-dried liver and there's only one ingredient and they're all natural and she would work for them for me. But when Jason had the super smelly treats in his pouch, she looked at me and she was like, there's a better offer over there. And she was listening to Jason a little bit better than me. And I was like, baby girl, come on. And she was like, okay, I'll work for you too, as long as you maybe get some treats out of the bag. And then we were all good. Oh, and the human. Anyway, human treats. Jason enjoys anything salty, like pretzels. Those are his favorite. And Adam enjoys the Dinamita Dorito chips.
What are those? They're like really spicy
Doritos. Oh, those are the smoking spicy ones.
Yeah, they're like rolled up into
Oh, yeah, those are good.
Uh-huh. And he's like, Mom, would you like one? Mom, would you like one? Mom. Hey, Linda. Would you like them? My name's not Linda. I do not like hot and spicy things, so I always say no thank you, and Adam still tries.
What's your favorite snack?
Mom's favorite snack? Oh, hold on. Mom's favorite snack is raisins.
No, I absolutely cannot stand raisins. Raisins are disgusting. Right. But anyway, I don't know about my favorite chips. Chips, yeah. Okay, when Jason and I were best friends, well, he's been my best friend for 26 years, but when we were just dating, we have a store called The Real Canadian Superstore, and it had these chips, these really salty chips, these no-name brand chips. OMG. We would eat those by the bag, and we would just be like, I'm sure pickled on the inside because they were so salty. But we really liked them.
They still are really salty. We're going to go for the next one. It's from Dan Fry. Is he a patron? Then Dan Fry, you're a patron. Good job. Does either doggo get to sleep in the bed with a human? Dad, this is for you.
We would love it if they slept in the bed with us. At least I would. Our golden that we had before Bunsen slept on my side of the bed for her whole life. And then when she died, I really missed having her on my side of my bed. I actually had sleep problems after that. We have a noise machine in our room. Bunsen is pretty choosy about when he wants to sleep and cuddle. So he'll come randomly some nights and then jump up in the bed for a bit. But he always finds a position that protects the family. So even if we're in a new place, he finds a position that's in the middle of the household. So if people are upstairs, he'll be on the main floor, kind of in the middle where everybody's sleeping. And that's where he sleeps today. He sleeps by the front door, or he'll sleep now by Beaker, equidistance from Beaker in our room. That's where Bunsen sleeps. Beaker cuddles in the bed a lot, but she's still crate trained. So she sleeps in her crate at night.
Because she would chew
everything. She would wreck everything. So it's for her own safety and ours, I guess, the safety of our household. Beaker's really cuddly on the couch, and it doesn't matter who it is. She jumps up and cuddles with everybody. She loves to sleep with Adam on the couch and with Chris, and then sometimes me, and it's just it brings such warm memories back of our golden we had before. Because Bunsen's cuddly, but he's not golden retriever cuddly.
All right, so here comes the last question. It's for me. How does the change in weather affect Bunsen? This one is from Kathleen Zerker.
She's also a patron.
Yeah, I thought you guys said it was Zerker. How does the change in weather affect Bunsen? Short answer, it doesn't. Bunsen is like a tank, all right? He's built like a tank, and B, he has very thick fur, so he does not get cold. The one thing that we have to watch out for, though, is on the paws. They get, like, little... I'm going to answer another question, which would be better for the podcast, because, like, I don't want it to end on, no, it doesn't affect Bunsen. I want to be like, Beaker, on the other hand. Beaker does get cold. As a puppy, when we went kayaking, she'd be shivery in the car.
Oh, that's right.
Beaker has the same problem where her paws get ice cubes, but it's a lot worse than Bunsen, because her paws are not, like... tree stumps. Her paws are like saplings. But yeah, so yeah, that's the end of the mailbag. Close it on up. It kind of changes material every single time that we do the podcast, doesn't it? Thank you for all of your questions. I really enjoyed answering them, and I hope my parents did too. And I hope to see you next time. Bye bye.
That's it for this week's podcast. Thanks so much for listening, and special thanks to our guest, Daniel Bush, who talked to us about chemistry, baking, and some really real conversations about some fun football stuff, but also some very serious matters, like with Black Lives Matter. We'd also like to give a special shout out to our top-tier patrons on Patreon who make the podcast possible. Their support allows the podcast to spread far and wide, and here they are. Take it away, Chris.
Catherine Lynch, Judith Morton, Mary Coos, Marianne McNally, Daniel Fry, Shelby Leggett, Karen Beth St. George, Andrea Persons, Bianca Hyde, Brooke Lavallo, Kathy Zerker, Liz Button, and Ben Rathert.
Let's end with the dog's motto: for science, empathy, and cuteness.